It's funny, isn't it? When you're studying somebody who, when you're studying something that, that you're studying as an abstraction, it's like some of the philosophers we've looked at over the months, and you're studying them as an abstraction, you get it very clear in your head, you can kind of present the ideas, and it's all very kind of level. When there are these guys, when there are people you would, like you and Wittgenstein, who you are genuinely impassioned about, then all sense of kind of, you know, rigor and dispassionate engagement just leak out of your ears, and you just start kind of going, oh, and then there's this. Oh, look at this, Daniel, look at this. Over here, come over here, look at this. you know, I mean, Husserl talks about, as you say, he talks about the eidetic experience. And this is this business of trying to kind of come up with, you know, try and identify what's the necessary essence of an experience. And we were just talking previously about you know, for example, being in love. You know, what's the essence, the eidetic essence, the real core of that experience. And you can start, as you say, part of it has that kind of, as you say, that smattering of kind of Cartesian, the Cartesian method of doubt, stripping stuff away. Some of it even reminds me a little bit of Locke and primary and secondary qualities. So all of that stuff is kind of floating around in the background. And he's saying, you know, what we do as when we're philosophizing on these things, is we try to get to the heart of it, we're kind of peeling the layers back. And, you know, it's like, I don't know, as we're talking about love, you know, Is it a violent emotion? Is it a quiet? Can it be a quiet emotion? Is it necessarily romantic? Is it necessarily sexual? Is it necessarily this? Who's involved? And you can start stripping away all these things and try and get to the core. The problem with that, and I've got nothing wrong with that, but as a method, the problem with that is that, and I'm still trying to work this through. It almost seems to presuppose that you know already. Yes. What this thing is, because otherwise how could you decide what it doesn't need? So if you said, okay, well, it doesn't need this and it doesn't need that and it doesn't need to be passionless and it doesn't need to be between two people and it doesn't need to be there, if you're already stripping that away to get to an essence, then in a sense you've already established the criteria for what it is, and you already kind of know what it is.
Foucault does, I think Foucault does this, doesn't he? Talks about this in his critique of Descartes, and it's, I think, a critique of psychology, saying that the conclusion has already been reached.
Yeah,
you know, and what we're doing is that we're just bringing our prejudice in.
Yeah,
in that way.
So So that concerns me a little bit. I like the what he calls the kind of the phenomenological attitude, which is the more existential side, which is kind of, you know, what does this, you know, what does this mean for me? Engaging with the world, and my consciousness is almost a kind of, it's a kind of thing that blankets the world. Every time I kind of move into a place, and my consciousness is kind of, it's part of the whole environment, and I'm trying to kind of, you know, and it's my world. I like that, but what concerns me a little bit, and I still need to work this through, is there a prejudgment? Where does that come from? You know, is there something that provides me with the tools I need to analyze something, to be able to say, yes, this is definitely a mug, this is definitely love, because I know what it is, because I've stripped away all the stuff. You know, how do you know what you don't know? It's like, you know, it's like if you're cooking something, you can say, well, okay, what's the essence of a lasagna? You can say, well, it has to have pasta in it. It has to have some sort of like white sauce. It has to have some sort of meat or meat based substitute as a kind of a like tomato-y kind of.
Well done.
And it needs to, yeah. But you know, people say, well, you know, does it actually have to have meat? Could it have corn? Would that work okay? You know, does it matter what kind of cheese you use? You know, does the sauce? And you can say, well, no, it doesn't. It doesn't need meat. You can do it with a vegetarian substitute. But it definitely needs pasta. How do I know it definitely needs pasta? I mean, that's obviously a line in the sand in its definition. that it has to have that. And that seems to come before I actually start doing the eidetic process of analysing it down. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
So that worries me a little bit. The other thing, well, or not worries me, but it intrigues me a little bit, The other thing that intrigues me is, as you were saying, the danger that it might create, might fragment human experience.
Mm.
Because I like the idea that we have a shared human world. If we don't have a shared human world, and we're very much living in a world now which is trying to encourage the fact that we don't share a common human world, both kind of environmentally, but also kind of, you know, ideologically and philosophically and socially and so on. So I don't like anything which could give permission for that. And yes. I worry that perhaps this kind of approach, which has a more subjectivist idea that this is my world and I'm interpreting it in my way, might give permission for that. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I'd have to apologise, because all I can think of is the Wittgenstein stuff.
This is why you're here. This is why we have you here.
So he would say, you know, I think he gives the example of he talks about a student in his class. I think his name was Redpath.
Mm-hmm.
His surname was Redpath. We can reduce Redpath down to, under a lamp or something. We can reduce him down to these fundamental like ashes of the essence of Redpath. But he said that's just one way of looking at him. Is that if we reduce him down? Is that, you know, these ashes, these things? Is this what Redpath is? You know,
yes,
it's impossible. And famously, Wittgenstein, as I've said many times, probably, is the perspicuous representation.
Mm,
mm. We like phenomenology in a way. We keep looking at things from different angles, and, you know, eternally, there will never be one way of looking at something.
Yes. Yeah.
So from my way of looking at it, is I think obviously Husserl is, and phenomenology is really interesting, because it's like the beginnings of something that will blossom into lots of different things.
Mm.
But I think that they've ultimately, you know, defeated before they start.
Mm.
Yeah, if you look at it from the kind of postmodern view.
Yes, yeah. Well, of course, postmodernism, you know, existentialism, postmodernism, so on, all build in various ways on the kind of phenomenological project. That, you know, we're not talking about a grand narrative. We're not talking about one way of interpreting and one way of defining the world. That's very much the Enlightenment project. That was very much the kind of pre-Enlightenment kind of Christian Europe project, that you have one story, one way of seeing. And if you diverge from the orthodoxy, then, you know, you're going to hell, or you're going to be ostracized or whatever. So I like that, you know, what Husserl is trying to do here, which is just is introducing this idea of lived worlds, if you like.
Mm.
And he starts to get into the idea of life worlds in some of his later works, which Heidegger begins to pick up. And I like that. Each person, in a sense, you know, creates the world they live in. I believe that very strongly. We interpret, we create, and that doesn't mean necessarily to say that any one of us is deviating from a norm. There isn't the thing in itself. There isn't the norm, the grand narrative, the world. And you and I are either closer or further away from it, depending on how accurate our philosophy is. I like the idea that there are a multiplicity of worlds that people inhabit. What I'm struggling with, and this is where my current research is at, is how do you maintain that while still wanting to assert a shared existence, a meaningful shared existence that doesn't collapse into kind of solipsism. This is my world and that's your world, and they don't overlap. What is the point of overlay? Is kind of where I'm interested in.
Yeah, yeah. Again, I think of Wittgenstein references. It's like, if we, so obviously Wittgenstein was talking about language.
Mm.
So when we see Husserl introduces some new language here.
Mm-hmm.
But it's our understanding of that language as well. We kind of jump in when we learn language. We're jumping in a world that's already been created.
Yes,
the world of language is there before we exist, and then we get into that we get into that world by understanding those words and understanding the structures of those words, but our interpretation of those words cannot be, or you know, will not be completely the same. But still, there must be a link. You know, there must be a I think in one of the books, Wittgenstein books, it talks about is it the Erbpflanzer? Have we already talked about this? I can't remember.
Yeah.
But to do with so we're not talking about scientific structures. We're talking about plants and flowers. And there's a story of a man trying to find the ultimate kind of genesis of a plant. It must be here somewhere, looking at, you know, different plants. And
yeah.
So it's linked together, but different. You know, much like family resemblances.
Yeah.
So like a rope, will have lots of threads on it, which are connected and part of the same rope, but different.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No, like that. That is interesting, isn't it? It is interesting. I can see what Husserl is trying to do when he engages with that kind of eidetic project, because he is trying to say, well, you know, what's the core experience when we're talking about love? What's the core experience when we're talking about anger? Or what's the core experience when we're talking about mugs and trees and all the phenomena that we encounter in the world? What is the core? And to some extent, I think perhaps he is trying to identify, you know, whether there is a common core around which the mass variety of my own personal and your own personal phenomenological experience wraps around that. So, you know, there's a core, but then you and I then add our own flavour, perhaps. Maybe that's what he's reaching to. But so anything that starts to talk about reduction, as you said when you were talking about fiction time just now, always kind of makes me, you know, makes my kind of the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. Because
that's always a big problem, isn't it? It's like a political problem too, you know, because we want to have a strong identity so we know where we are, but then strong identity can lead then to more isolation.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you can identify. I mean, one of the big problems at the moment is in human thought, certainly philosophical thought, is the kind of the mind brain distinction. I mean, can you account for all human experience in terms of brain chemistry? Is that really all it is to be?
This really raises red flags for me when I hear this as well.
Absolutely.
Instinctively, I really distrust it.
Oh yeah, you and me both. Yeah. And I don't have enough science background to be able to argue it. But it does concern me that if you think, well, okay, it smacks of behaviorism and the kind of reductionism of human identity.
When you eugenics, say, well,
yeah,
it could.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, if it is all to do with brain chemistry, and I'm not saying brain chemistry is not an issue. I mean, brain chemistry is kind of part. Clearly, we're biological beings. We're part of a biological world. But can you reduce it to that? Can you? I mean, it's maybe I'm just an old romantic. But you know, if somebody says to me, "Oh, well, you know, you're in love with somebody," but that is all really to do with the relative balance of chemicals in your brain. Is that all it can be reduced to? I mean, maybe, but I don't like that, and I would try to argue against. Well, yeah. I tell you what brings to mind, and you'll appreciate this: the Star Trek transporter. Always worried about that, because what you've got here is anybody who's familiar with Star Trek will know this. Those of you who are not familiar with Star Trek, shame on you. The transporter was like a MacGuffin that was built into the early 1960s Star Trek because they couldn't afford each week to create the special effect of landing a spaceship on a planet. It's too expensive. So they developed this transporter technology, which has become absolutely central to the Star Trek universe. And the idea is that you get into it at one point. This device disassociates your molecules, the physical stuff of who you are, Yeah. It manages to create a map of those molecules, the exact map. I mean, you know, let's go with this, of how these molecules are put together again to form you. And then the molecules on the map get transferred to another point where a similar machine will reconstruct those molecules into you.
Mm.
Now, I can remember as a kid thinking, does it reconstruct you as you? I mean, it's taken the physical aspect, all the kind of chemicals and all the kind of material, and it's taken that apart and it's sent this through space with a map to putting it all together again. But it almost smacked of a kind of a Frankenstein's monster sort of thing, which is, you know, you've got all these body parts that you know, Frankenstein's got, and each of the individual body parts you can kind of take to another part of the world, put it in a laboratory, and sew them all together. And what have you made? I mean, have you made a human being, or what have you made? So I've always wondered what was left behind.
Yeah.
You know?
You think, if you have a machine that can take your molecules apart, then that machine must truly understand what makes a person.
Yes.
And that's almost impossible. Well, it's impossible.
Yes. I mean, the other side of that, I remember thinking, I was well into this as a kid. If you've got an exact map, an exact instruction set for how to put together Danny, so we've transported you from one place, like last week when we transported Vanessa from Australia to WTF Mansions, okay, and she kind of came out of the transporter and there was Vanessa. So we have her map stored in the WTF transporter. As long as we feed in enough raw material, could we make another Vanessa out of that?
I reckon it must be like they must put safeguards in there, like Snapchat. You know, Snapchat.
Yeah, yeah. So the instructions on the map get wiped before you can actually use it. Because, you know, you could just end up mass producing. You could just say, well, I've got the kind of the digital master of Vanessa, or the digital master of whatever. As long as I keep putting in biological material, or whatever material you need to, we could just churn out a load of them. And that's getting away a little bit from. I mean, Husserl would never have entertained that kind of thinking. But it's that kind of reductionist, reducing things to an essence. I can see why people want to do it, because it's kind of easy, it's kind of neat to be able to say this is what it is. And a lot of the early and a lot of the philosophers we've looked at over the months, have done this. You know, you'll get Plato, the archetype of this, saying, okay, this is what things are. You know, a dog, a mug, a cup, beauty, truth. There is the absolute uncontested blueprint existing in some spiritual and metaphysical world. And anything we encounter that claims to be a mug or love or beauty or truth has to at least approximate to that thing. And the further it gets away from that template, the less it is that thing. So the further you get away from that absolute, this is what beauty is, this is what a human being is, then the more it loses that its character. So you get to that point where you can say, this has moved so far away from the ideal of, you know, the perfect ideal of a human being, that this is not human anymore. Yeah, that's a worry.